Okay, welcome back. Thanks so much for coming back promptly at 2 o'clock. It's a great pleasure to introduce a friend and brilliant scientist, Bruce Bischel, who's at the Martino Center at Harvard Medical School. Bruce's algorithms, as many of the neuroscientists know, are very, very widely used, both for analysis of the surface of the cortex and also for automated parcellation of brain on MRI. And we're very honored to have Bruce here today to talk about the principles behind those algorithms. Thanks, Bruce.
Thanks, Paul. So I wanted to start with three small things before I start my talk. The first is, I don't know if anyone has said this before, but Paul was this year's Human Organization for Human Brain Mapping Young Investigator, and it was richly deserved. So congratulations. Okay, so the second thing is that because we had a cancellation today, Paul has asked me to ramble on a bit long, which will actually be pretty easy for me, which relates to my third point, that Paul tells me that the last time I spoke at IPAM, I averaged twice as many words per minute as any other speaker in the entire course. So please, my natural metabolic pace is exceedingly fast. I find it impossible to slow down. I'll do my best, but if you have questions, please feel free to interrupt me. I know it's hard in a room this size, but please feel free to.
What did you just
say? Okay, don't interrupt me anymore. Okay, so I'm going to talk about some work that we've been doing for the last 10 years or so that really started with Anders Dell when he was in San Diego. And for us, when we talk about extracting information from MRIs of the brain, we really divide the world in two, and we deal with the cortex separately from the way we deal with the rest of the brain. And I'm sure that when David Van Esten spoke this morning, he gave a lot of the motivation behind this, but I'm going to reiterate it a little bit. So this is how I'll organize the talk. I'll talk about what we do with the cortex. I'll kind of talk about about what we do with the rest of the brain, and then I'll talk about how we link the macroscopically visible properties that we can see with MR to the microstructural properties that we know are there that are really the foundation of a lot of what imaging data is looking for. Okay, so we'll start with cortex. So why do we care about building surface models of the brain, of the cortex? So here I'm talking about this thin little layer of gray matter that's out here. It varies between, a millimeter and a half and 4 millimeters thick. And David's probably already told you that it's about the size of a medium pizza pie. I don't know if you use that, yes. So I've heard David say that before. And if that's all we knew about it, so we know that topologically it has the topology of a sheet. If you haven't had a stroke, there are no holes through it, there are no bridges across the sulci. It has an Euler number of 1. And if it was only the anatomy of it, if it was only the structure that we knew had this interesting topology, probably there would be, you know, 5 or 6 anatomists somewhere in the world who were very interested in this, but everyone else in the world wouldn't care. But what we know about the functional properties of the cortex is that they're laid out as this mosaic on the cortical sheet, and that understanding the two-dimensional structure of the cortex is critical in order to understand the functional properties of the cortex. And so here's an example of something I stole from Marty Cirino's 1995 science paper, where Marty developed this automated technique for quantifying the borders between visual areas. And so here's the occipital third of cortex that's been cut and is flattened till I flatten the plane, and I'll talk about how we do this a little bit later. So the dark gray are sulci, the light gray are gyri. And Marty developed this technique that allowed him to automatically delineate these borders between V1 here in yellow. Sorry, too much coffee at lunch. So here's V1 in yellow, and here's V2 in blue, and here's V3 again in yellow. And so each one of these areas contains a representation of half of the visual field, and then the next visual area contains another representation of the same portion of visual space. And you can see this very simple rectangular pattern on the flattened cortical surface. But in the volume, so the way that we look at almost all of our imaging data, this pattern is a mess. Right? We can't make out the V1, V2 border. This clear functional organization is lost in the volume. And in fact, the way that Marty delineates these boundaries is itself a function of the position and orientation of the cortical surface at each point in space. And so having access to this type of surface model enables analyses that are completely inaccessible otherwise. Okay, so this is why we kind of got into the business of trying to build surface models in the first place. Anything to be done about that? I don't think so. Okay. Try that. Okay, so why is constructing a model of the surface hard? Mostly it comes from the fact that the cortex is highly folded. So the radius of curvature of the cortex is smaller than the size of our imaging voxels in many places in the brain. And this problem is compounded by many technical factors, many technical and biological factors. So we have partial voluming, we have subject motion, susceptibility artifacts, bias fields, and tissue and homogeneities. All these factors go into causing intensity of a tissue class to vary across space. So, for example, if we peg the white matter intensity to be, say, 100 in an MR volume, it'll be 100 somewhere, but many places it'll be 90, many other places it'll be 110. And so this makes segmentation difficult. So I'm not going to talk about these. I think we had a segmentation talk earlier today. But I just want to also stress the fact that a lot of this variability that we see is actually in the anatomy. So we know histologically that some tissue has a lot of myelin, some tissue has less myelin, and this causes the intensity of the tissue to vary over space. And it's critical to model this if we want to be able to segment things accurately. Okay, so for a long time, people were trying to generate models of the pleural surface. So the pleural surface is kind of what you see if you take a brain out of a skull. And this is extremely difficult to do. I mean, this is kind of what we think of as the brain, but the problem is that adjacent banks of a sulcus, so two sides of a fold, can be physically adjacent. And so it's impossible to resolve which side of the fold you're on directly from the imaging data. And so many people for a long time tried to resolve the pleural surface directly, but an alternative in the early 90s was proposed by Anders Dale and Maurice Cirino, which was to construct a representation of the gray-white boundary in the brain and then to use this to infer the location of the true pleural surface. Okay, so here's an example. So we can take this type of T1 weighted MR, we can strip off the skull, label the white matter, separate the cortical hemispheres, and then cover each cortical hemisphere with a bunch of triangles, edges, and points in order to build a true surface model of the cortex. And so now I've color-coded this surface model red for things that are folded in. They have positive Gaussian, positive mean curvature, and green for things that are folded out. So the green are the gyri and the red are the sulci. Okay, so how do we go about building these things? Well, one big problem is the topology of the model that we're trying to build. So as I said before, we know that the true topology of the cortical ribbon is that of a sheet. It has an Euler number of 1. It doesn't have holes or handles. But there are many reasons why the topology of the reconstructed model departs from the true topology of the cortical sheet. So we do a segmentation, we cover the surface of the white matter, and we wind up with something that has an Euler number of minus 10 or minus 15. So what do we do about these things where the topology is broken, and why are they important? So here's an example of a segmentation, and this surface should look smooth, so this is an inflated surface, which I'll talk about in a little bit. But because of errors in the segmentation and also because of the true anatomy of the white matter surface, we have things like holes here where the basal ganglia are. Okay, let me get a better example. So here's an example of a topological defect. So this is the central sulcus here. Here's a bridge connecting the two sides. Here's a hole in the banks of the sulcus. So topologically, these things are equivalent. We can't tell the difference between them topologically. Geometrically, they're very different. And this also illustrates why the topological defects are a problem. So imagine that you're trying to analyze the functional properties of the brain, and you have a point here with some functional activation, and you do some smoothing on it. And so the smoothing happily crosses this bridge into the adjacent bank, into a piece of cortex that is many centimeters distant, functionally has nothing to do with this little piece of cortex right here, but now they become functionally indistinguishable because of this break in topology. And so we've spent a long time thinking about how to correct these topological defects without sacrificing accuracy. And so historically, the way that this was done, and I think a lot of the early work was Christos Davatsikos and David McDonald did a PhD on this, was to try and take a surface of known topology and shrink wrap it onto the cortex. Right? So you start with the topology of the sphere and you force it to lie at the junction either the gray-white border or the pleural surface, and you don't let the topology change during this type of deformation. And this is really hard. And the reason it's really hard is that this surface is much smoother than this surface. Right? And so you can think about taking this surface and trying to shove enough of the surface area down into this deep sulcus in order to accurately model it. Right? So if you get to this point right here, most surface deformation algorithms are happy to just sit there and not push the surface into the deep folds. And so this was really difficult for people for a long time. We kind of took a different approach. So as I said, this is what I said before, the initial surface of the sphere is typically much smoother than the target surface of the cortex. So finding this mapping, M, that takes my initial surface to the cortex is highly non-convex. So it has to pass through these non-smooth configurations before it finds itself into this final smooth configuration. So another problem is that you can imagine with these surface deformations is that if you have an error in the topology like this, and you constrain the topology of the evolving surface, then it'll drape over this little handle here. And what was a small topological error will become a large geometric error. Right? Is that clear to everybody? Okay. So we kind of do the opposite. So what we do instead is we take our brain MRI, we segment it as best we can, not really caring about the topology. Whatever topology it has, it has. Then we derive an energy functional that takes this surface with the wrong topology and drives it outward to the surface of the sphere. So this is an easy mapping to find because we're taking a highly folded surface and smoothing it, right? We know how to do this. Okay. So when we drive this surface out to the sphere, all we care about now is the topology of the surface. We don't care anything about any of the geometric properties. All we're trying to do is find an invertible mapping that associates every point on here, a single unique point on there, and vice versa. So for every button here, we have a single unique point on here. So if these surfaces had the same topology, then by definition, I could find this type of mapping. They would be topologically equivalent if I can find this type of homeomorphic mapping. But precisely in regions where the mapping is not homeomorphic are the regions where we have these defects, where you have two bits of surface that map to the same point on the sphere. So you get overlapping triangles, and this is kind of a hallmark of what we call a topological defect, a place where the surface topology departs from the spherical. Okay, so here's kind of how we do it. So this is the determinant of the Jacobian of the mapping. So if the mapping was positive definite everywhere, if this number was positive everywhere, the mapping would be invertible and we would be done. So we take the determinant of the Jacobian and we run it through a nonlinearity that looks like this. And so this is zero here, I don't know if everybody can see in the back. So this is positive, this is negative. So we don't care what the Jacobian is if it's positive. It can be anything as long as it's positive, because in those reasons we have an invertible mapping. So we only penalize the Jacobian as it starts to become negative. And so this will drive the surface into configurations where it's essentially unfolded, where triangles don't lie on top of each other. Okay, and this lets us now segment the defects. So we can take this and we can move back one. So we can minimize our energy functional like this. And then the result of that will be a mapping that takes each point in the cortex onto the sphere. And the places where I have more than one point mapping to the same place on the sphere are precisely the locations of the defects. So here's an example. Sorry, is that hard to see? Can we turn the lights down? Or yeah. Okay, so these red locations are the locations that we found the topology of the surface on the sphere being incorrect. And what's nice about this algorithm is that it localizes the changes we're going to make to this vanishingly small number of regions in the brain. So everywhere else, the segmentation will remain unchanged. And it's only in these places that we're going to actually try and change things. And here's just a zoom to show the localization of a defect. So here's a handle. And you can see how the points underneath this handle and the points on top of this handle will map to the same place when you drive them to the surface of the sphere. And therefore, we know that the topology is incorrect. So I won't go through all the details, but essentially the game that we'll play here is that we mark all the triangles where there's overlap, where two triangles sit on top of each other. We discard all the connectivity information in those regions because we know the connectivity is wrong. We know the topology is wrong. So we'll throw out all the edges and all the faces in these regions. And then Florent Segond, who was a graduate student of mine, generated a genetic algorithm in which we keep adding edges to the tessellation and faces to the tessellation until we can't add any more. And this is known from graph theory that will actually generate a topologically correct tessellation this way. And here we actually care about self-intersection both on the surface of the sphere and in the embedding space. So when we add an edge, it's constrained not to pass through another edge either on the sphere, and the triangle that's generated can't pass through another triangle in the 3D embedding space. And so formally the way we do this is we optimize the posterior density of the observed surface given, of the surface given the observed image. So, and this is actually quite a strong constraint. This lets us generate a surface that, for example, has gray matter on the outside and white matter on the inside. And it also lets us put priors on the surface that we're going to observe, the surface that we're going to derive, which is that it has to be smooth at a certain spatial scale. Okay, is that stuff clear? Okay, so here's just kind of a toy example. Here's an example of a surface before we've generated the topological correction, and here's the same surface afterwards. And so here, this surface is now guaranteed to have an Euler number of 2. It's topologically equivalent to a sphere. It has no holes or handles. Okay. So once we have this type of surface, we can do all sorts of things to it. The most common one that we do, because the Peel surface, you can only see about 30% of the surface area from an external view, the first thing we usually do is take this thing and just inflate it like a balloon. So we model it as a network of springs with some terms to preserve surface area, and minimizing the energy functional just inflates the surface. Okay, so I'm going to use this type of red-green pattern to show on subsequent slides. So here, again, red are sulci, green are gyri. Here I've coded it not by mean curvature, but by depth. Okay, so I'm showing how deep a sulcus was, and you can kind of see that on this surface too. Okay, so depth is actually a better marker of kind of genetic stability. So the sulci that are the deepest are also the ones that we know are kind of phylogenetically the oldest and also the most stable across subjects. So David probably talked about this a little bit too. Okay, and then this is just to show that we're actually deforming on the MR volume itself. And so here you can see, kind of graphically, how knowing where the white matter boundary is helps you locate the true Peel surface. So here's the location. I don't know if people can see that in the back. Let's find one higher up. No, sorry. So here's a location where the surface is constrained not to pass through itself. So the surface expands outwards, but then it finds another piece of surface and can't keep expanding. And so knowing the white matter boundary helps you infer where the true Peale surface is. So an alternative to surface inflation is we can flatten it. Because we know the cortex itself is topologically equivalent to a sheet, we can find a mapping from the cortex down into the plane. So here, the inflated surface is kind of a nice surface for visualization purposes. You know, it kind of looks like a brain. You can tell where a frontal pole is an occipital pole. You can show it to a radiologist, and they'll say, yeah, that's a brain. But the problem with it is that it takes about 6 views to see the whole thing. Right, so I have to kind of, this is the medial view, I have to flip it around and flip it up and flip it down. We can't see all of cortex at a single view. So an alternative is to introduce some cuts to remove some of the Gaussian curvature, because there's a fair amount of Gaussian curvature in the folded surface, and then minimize the functional that minimizes the metric distortion to generate a planar representation. So play the movie this. So here's an example of the energy functional unfolding. And so this is a lovely domain for visualization. We can see the entire cortex at a single view. The problem is that it takes some orienting to it. It doesn't look like a brain anymore. So this is the Kaplan sulcus back here. This is kind of posterior. This is frontal pole. Here's the Sylvian fissure. We've introduced a cut in the Kaplan, so the Kaplan is kind of unfolded here. Okay, so why do we want to use this kind of thing? Here's an example that I stole from Eric Kalgren's paper in 1999 in human brain mapping, where we can see all of cortical activation in a single view. So it's an incredibly useful visualization tool. So here, Eric was looking at regions of the brain that are more activated to faces than other things. So this is what we would usually call the fusiform face area. So here we can see where the fusiform face area is. We can see V1, V2. We can see that the fusiform face area is, you know, a centimeter or two anterior to the retinotopic cortex. And we can kind of make out the entire mosaic in a single view. So it is really a lovely domain for visualization. I know that David uses it all the time. It's kind of become a vanished art at MGH. Not very many people use this anymore. Okay, so now I want to talk about intersubject averaging. Has anyone talked about Telerik and Turneau? Yeah? Okay, good. So we mean many different things these days when we talk about a Telerik transform. Originally, it meant a piecewise linear transform. These days, mostly people mean a linear transform to an atlas coordinate system, usually a 12 degree of freedom transformation, usually a volumetric transformation based on image intensities, although it can mean many different things. And this coordinate system is good for many things, but one of the things it's not good for is analyzing cortical data. And so for cortex, it's a bad thing to do for at least 3 reasons. The first is that the folds are extremely idiosyncratic. They vary highly across individuals. And 12 numbers are not enough to describe the differences across subjects. Right? So it just doesn't have enough degrees of freedom in order to describe cortical geometry well. A second is that the landmarks that are typically used to define the Telerik coordinate system are mostly subcortical, they're mostly around the center of the brain. And so you can imagine that a small error in landmark alignment around the center of the brain gives rise to a large linear displacement around the surface. So you can, you know, if you think of the brain as a big balloon, you're aligning the center, and a little rotational error causes a big linear displacement way out in the cortex. So these displacements can be a couple of centimeters, they can be large, they can be the size of a cortical area, the size of a functionally defined cortical area. And the last kind of, probably the most subtle point, which maybe David talked about as well, is that there's an implicit assumption that things that are close together in 3D are functionally similar. They have something to do with each other. But it's easy to see in the cortex, there are many places where this is not true. So here's a brain. So this is an average of 40 subjects in the Telerik coordinate system. Here's a single subject. And if I can pick a place here. So right here are 2 pieces of gray matter. They're, I don't know, 2 millimeters apart in the volume along the surface. So the way the connectivity goes, they're multiple centimeters apart. They're 5-6 centimeters apart. You've got to go all the way into the Sylvian fissure and all the way around to get from there to here. Functionally, they have nothing to do with each other. They're in completely disparate parts of the brain. But in the Telerik coordinate system, these 2 points are indistinguishable. You would not be able to say whether your functional activation comes from one or the other across subjects in Telerik. Okay? And the other point that's kind of easy to see from this kind of image is that scan time is precious. You know, in MR, scan time, you pay an SNR price for reducing your scan time. Particularly clinically, it's difficult to get long scans. And so this kind of averaging is a terrible thing to do to a brain. Right? You've spent all your time trying to acquire this beautiful high-resolution data, and then you throw away this resolution in your averaging procedure for really no reason. Okay. So enough bashing in Telerik. Okay, so we're going to do something a little bit different, which I think is probably similar to some stuff that David showed before. Our hypothesis here was that the folding patterns are better predictors of the functional properties of the brain than are the image intensities. Okay, and this is not, you know, this is not some novel hypothesis that we came up with. And we know that the folds are good predictors of the functional properties. We know that primary visual cortex is in the calcarine sulcus. We know that primary motor and primary somatosensory are in the central sulcus. And so we know that the folds are pretty good predictors. And again, there are people who will argue to the death how well the functional properties are predicted by the anatomy, but by and large, the anatomy is a pretty good predictor. The geometry of the cortex is a pretty good predictor. But the geometry, as I said before, is also highly idiosyncratic. So it was pointed out to me when some years after I made this slide, that two of these brains are actually the same. I don't know which two they are anymore. But it speaks to how complicated these folding patterns are, that it's actually very difficult to pick out which two are the same, right? Okay, so we want to come up with a representation that simplifies this type of high-frequency information but also retains the large-scale geometry. And so what we use is what I showed you before is kind of the depth of a sulcus, so how deep a point lies. Let's see if I have an example. Okay, so we'll talk about this one. So here I've color-coded the surfaces with mean curvature. Okay, so again, red is stuff that's folded in, green is stuff that's folded out, so concave and convex. But the mean curvature is a local property of the surface. And it's a local differential property of the surface that highlights local geometry. It's not a global property of the geometry. And so you can see lots of locations, let's see, like this one right here. Right? This is a point that's pretty much on the crown of a gyrus. It's pretty much as superficial as you can get. But if I look at the mean curvature, it looks like a sulcus. It has the same assigned mean curvature as the stuff that's way in the depths of the sulcus. And so this, as a geometric, as a representation of the large-scale geometry, is a poor feature. Okay. So what we use instead is kind of the depth, how far into a sulcus a point is, or how high on the crown of a gyrus a point is. And then we'll derive an energy functional that takes each one of these individual geometric patterns, drives it to the surface of a sphere, and then we'll derive some statistics across subjects, take each one of these red-green patterns on the surface of the sphere, and find some transformation that aligns them. Okay? Is that clear? Okay. So here's some of the math that we're using. So we build an energy functional that has three terms in it. It has a correlation term that encourages folding patterns to align, so the red with the red, the green with the green. It has a metric distortion term, which I'll talk about in a second, and then a topology term. And the topology term is actually very similar to the one I showed you before that prevents folding the triangles. So we want a mapping that's invertible so that we can go from any subject to another and then back to the first subject. So the metric distortion term is a regularization on the warp, and it really amounts to a neuroscience prior. So we know that there's certain size scales in the brain that are invariant. We know that functional properties will change across individuals, but the size of a neuron is pretty much the same. So, you know, BET cells in motor cortex are 80 microns, and, you know, pyramidal cells are 40 microns, and that number's probably wrong. But so maybe they're 70 microns, maybe they're 90 microns, but they're not 10 microns. They're not 300 microns. And so we have this prior hypothesis that only allowing certain amounts of metric distortion across subjects is kind of the right thing to do. Okay. So I'm going to talk about this a little bit more detail later, so I wanted to show some of the details now just to motivate it. What we do is actually quite simple. I mean, we have a maximum likelihood term. So here's the correlation term where we have some geometric measure of the individual. So you can think about this as the sulcal depth or height of each point. We have some measure in the atlas, which is the mean across a bunch of subjects. And then we're going to divide by the variance in the atlas. Okay? So minimizing this thing encourages folding patterns to align. And furthermore, this variance term acts as a natural weighting. So it forces regions where the anatomy is very variable to be weighted less strongly. And this is actually a critical part in building a stable morph. It's one of the things that we found really allows the representation to work across lots of disease populations. Okay, so is this part clear also? So this is just a Gaussian smoothing. But basically what we're doing is we're looking at the folding of an individual minus the folding in an atlas divided by the variance in the atlas. Okay, so here's an example. So we actually use a two-stage process. We take each individual surface and we find a mapping to the sphere, to an individual sphere that minimizes the metric distortion. So you can see that the metric distortion in this surface is about the same here. So here you can kind of see that there's two stages in this morph. The first one is just kind of inflating it to the surface of the sphere. And then here's the Sylvian fissure. You can see it's kind of like Greenland initially. It's overrepresented. But then recovering the original metric properties gives it the same shape as the rest of the sulci. And this is actually critical for cross-subject warping because minimizing the metric distortion also retains the original shape of the sulci. And so we're going to take this kind of pattern and match it with the same pattern on a different subject. And so you can imagine that if we use this pattern here, So when the Cillian Fisher is way overrepresented, that we would derive the wrong morphing based on that.
Bruce, in the previous slide, the level line just, if you look at the central leaf, the big leaf, I don't know if it was...
This one?
Come down the...
Cillian Fisher?
The level line for that is so, it juts out like oak leaf pattern. That one.
So you're talking about these little sort of Great Britain type stuff?
That's basically a level line, right? It's where you're claiming switches from one. Is that, should we believe that? Or is that a manifestation of the whole process of going through all this claiming where we,
I guess what I would say is that at the end of the day, because we're dividing by the variance, it doesn't really matter. Right? So these regions, if these regions are stable across subjects, then they'll have low variance and we'll use them as features in the warping. But if these regions are variable across subjects, they'll get washed out. And then things will kind of snap into place based on the entire constellation of metric properties. Right, so you get a point here, and maybe its geometry isn't believable, but it should be a couple of millimeters from that, and a couple of millimeters from that, and a couple of millimeters from that.
Should, you said it's okay to ask questions, sorry. do you feel, could those little juts, could those relate, if I go all the way back to the original cortical surface, could those be the little... almost chaotic wrinkles, the non-stable.
They could be, but some of them actually have known functional properties, right? So, this is actually the hand area, and this is, I think, the hand area.
I'm not talking the big thing.
I'm not talking about the big thing either. So this little omega-shaped thing in the banks of the central sulcus is known to localize the hand area. Okay. So some of these secondary folding patterns actually have functional significance, and how many of them? I doubt anybody knows. Well, David would probably know as well as anybody. But certainly some of them do have functional significance. Okay, so here's an example of the cross-subject warping. So again, here's an individual, here's a representation of the atlas, and we're going to take these red-green patterns and move them around until they're in register with these. And at the end of the day, what we have is a coordinate system that's warped itself to account for the quirks in the individual anatomy. So that here's the central sulcus, here's the ventral tip of the central sulcus. The ventral tip of the central sulcus in the individual will inherit the coordinates of the ventral tip of the central sulcus in the atlas.
Can you come up with what's going on the right?
Oh, so this is actually the minimization of the functional. This is an old.
No. I mean, you see two parts.
You're talking about here. So this is actually. So let me talk about that a little bit later. So this warp. So the amount of regularization that you introduce into the warp is an open issue, right? So I could have no regularization except for topology, and I would match these two red green patterns almost perfectly, except for the topology is different, right? It turns out that that's a bad thing to do functionally. It's also a bad thing to do microstructurally, which I'll talk about in a little bit. So if you regularize this warp more, you'll find that the red-green patterns will not align as well, but the microstructural properties will align better, and you'll get more functional power. Okay, so here's kind of a comparison to what I showed you before, somewhat of a hand-wavy comparison, where I showed you the Telluride coordinate system, where we lose all the high-frequency structure of the cortex. Doing the same thing in spherical coordinates, you retain the distinction between opposing banks because they're far apart on the surface of the cortex. Okay, so this is an average of 30 subjects, kind of equivalent to what I showed you before, which was 40 subjects. Okay. So this type of coordinate system has many applications, and we've used it for all of these. I'm not going to talk about all of them. This is probably the most common. It's just that you get this big boost in statistical power over kind of affine transform averaging. One of the things that we use it for is to automate the labeling of the folding patterns in the brain. So we had Christophe Destrieux, who's a neuroanatomist, for his PhD, he manually labeled a set of cortical surface models like this. It was actually kind of an insane manual labeling. Christophe's an extremely detailed person. I think his original manual labeling had 80 parcellation units, so it was really every bump and divot in the cortex. I suspect that didn't turn out to be terribly reproducible, so we have downsampled that into a somewhat more manageable 60 or so units. So here, for example, the red is the central sulcus, and here's the precentral gyrus and postcentral gyrus, et cetera. And this type of highly accurate coordinate system makes segmenting the folding patterns actually relatively easy, because we have a strong understanding of where the central sulcus is just in our coordinate system. Right? So we can say that this point is likely to be central sulcus, and we find that it's folded in, so we label it central sulcus. And I'm going to talk about the details of how we do the segmentation a little bit later, because it's very similar to the way we segment in the volume. Okay, so I think one of the most common uses has just been doing morphometry. So we've used these type of surface models and the intersubject averaging in order to look at changes in the cortex across a wide variety of populations. This is just a few. This is a multiple sclerosis paper, Huntington's, schizophrenia, semantic dementia. And we're by no means the only people that are doing this. You know, there are many groups at Hopkins, among other places, doing cortical thickness studies. But what's kind of interesting about them is that you see these very, you know, each disease has kind of a different pattern of thinning. And these really relate to the functional consequences of the specific disorder, where this piece of cortex is affected and not that, or this network of cortex is affected and not that. And I know that this is something that I see John Ashburn is here. I know that John's very interested in looking at these entire networks and using them for discriminating different subject populations, which I think is a really cool application. And are you going to talk about that? Oh, sorry. Okay, another thing that we've been kind of actively pursuing here is shape analysis of the folding patterns. So the folding patterns are, you know, maybe I'm biased, but they're incredibly interesting. They, again, they have this regularity across subjects, but they also have this idiosyncratic component to them. You know, everyone, well, most people have a central sulcus, most people have a Sylvian fissure, but they're slightly different. They're deeper, they're longer, they have secondary folds or tertiary folds. And we've been trying to understand how they develop, but also what the consequences of changes in the folding patterns are. Actually, Guido probably talked about this as well, because I know that he's doing a lot of development stuff. So one of the things that we've been doing is working to build wavelet transforms. And so wavelet transforms have been used in the volume. So I should have put Christos Davatsikos here, who's really done some of the original work in applying wavelet transforms to the volume. We want to apply them on the surface. Thomas Yeo, who's a graduate student of mine, and Peng Yu and Paulina Goland, at the same time, actually, so this is one of these stories in science where you're developing something that you're so excited about, and just when you're writing up the paper, you read that someone else has done exactly the same thing. So Delphine Nan and Alan Tannenbaum developed something that was really almost identical to what we were doing. And so here we actually stole some stuff from the graphics literature where they do these biorthogonal wavelet decompositions. And the way you do a biorthogonal wavelet decomposition is you start with an icosahedral representation of the surface, and you iteratively subsample the icosahedron. And the subsampling also subsamples the basis functions. So I'm not going to talk terribly much about that because we have an alternative that I want to talk about. And so the problem with the biorthogonal wavelets, and so here, you know, we just published this year, but we've already found problems with it. The problem with the biorthogonal wavelets is that they're aliased. They undersample the surface. So the adjacent basis functions don't overlap at all. And the result is that the representation is not invariant to a rotation of the coordinate system. And so if I take a sphere like this and I just put a bump on it, right, and I use a coordinate system in which the basis function is perfectly aligned with the bump, I get a nice wavelet function, a nice power in the wavelet coefficient here, but nowhere else in the brain, or sorry, on the sphere. If I take the same function and I just rotate the underlying coordinate system, so I don't change my surface representation at all, then I find that the power actually gets split between two adjacent coefficients. And this is really a problem of aliasing, the basis set doesn't overlap enough. And so Thomas Yeo, where's Thomas? He's not on this slide. So Thomas Yeo, here he is. So Thomas developed this theory of filter banks on the sphere, which was actually the perfect thing for our use. And so here we do what's called an overcomplete wavelet decomposition, in which there's a lot of overlap in adjacent filter banks, or adjacent filters, and we can take any representation, derive the underlying coefficients, and then reconstruct the initial surface invariant to any rotations in the coordinate system. And we've applied this to a newborn study. This is in collaboration with Alan Grant, who's a pediatric neuroradiologist at MGH. So here we got 8 normal neonates. So here are the ages, from 30 weeks gestational age out to about 40 weeks. And then we threw a couple of kids in the mix, so 2, 3, and 7-year-olds. And the question was, how did the folding patterns form? So David also probably showed some movies of this. So the folds form, you know, sometime in, the 25th week, I guess, they start. And they form extremely rapidly. And by birth, they're mostly there. And then there are these slow changes that go on after the first year of life, and then they're pretty much fixed. So we applied the wavelet decomposition to this data set, and then looked at wavelet, so we did two things. One is we looked at wavelet power as a function of age in the different frequency bands. And so here, so level 0 is the coarsest spatial frequency, level 1 is the 2, 3, etc. And so this is one of the nice things about the wavelets, is that we get both spatial decomposition, but also spectral information. And so what we can see here, gestational age on the horizontal axis, and kind of power here vertically. What we can see is that, you know, this has kind of always been thought to be true, but to my knowledge hadn't been quantified before, is that the large folds form first. So these deep, large folds form earlier in gestation and reach their maximum growth earlier than these later folds. Right? And the other thing that we've seen, and I don't know whether this is true or not, is that the left hemisphere seems to form a little bit earlier than the right hemisphere. And just to give you an idea, so maybe I should start with a caveat that about half of this movie is science fiction. So we don't have longitudinal data. Longitudinal data, as you might imagine, is incredibly difficult to get. And so what we've done is we've taken our cross-sectional data and we've interpolated it over time. So some of the stuff that you see is undoubtedly just the quirks in the anatomy and isn't really development. But kind of the overall pattern, I think, the complexification you see in the folding patterns is real. And so take it with a grain of salt for what it's worth. So here's gestational age with zero being full term. And the time axis is log scale, right? Because all of the stuff happens. And then the other thing that's kind of interesting is you can see after birth, there's this slow loss of complexity. Right? The folds just kind of flatten out a little bit, which I think corresponds to a pruning process and myelination. And we think that this is real. We've seen this in a number of data sets. I don't know if Guido's seen something similar, so I'll just play it one more time. So again, so the fact that the superior temporal sulcus is getting deeper, I think, is real. The fact that it's kind of changing its angle is probably the quirks in the anatomy. Okay. That's it for cortex. Any questions on cortex? Yeah.
So suppose there are two areas where the gyrus has similar stuff, same surface area, but the sulcus has a deeper. Mm-hmm. Then when you inflate it, does the gyrus get kind of squished in the?
When we map across subjects, you mean?
No,
so we preserve metric properties in the inflation. So the inflation. So the property is actually distance, right? I think David may have an answer. I don't know. No, okay. So we preserve metric distortion. So we preserve the metric properties of the initial surface. We measure geodesic distances on the folded surface. And then whenever we do inflation or spherical mapping, we try and recover, we try and keep the geodesics of the evolving surface as close to the original surface as possible. And you can actually see it on the surface. You can see mappings that are good and bad because you'll get exactly what you say. You'll get. The sulcus will get squeezed down, and all the sulci, by and large, have the same width, kind of ballpark on the surface of the sphere. And if you see one way small and another one very big, that probably means you've found a suboptimal solution.
So it seems that if someone has a complicated sulci structure, then does it always come to be a sphere?
So the topology of the cortex is always the topology of the cortex is always a sheet, unless you've had a stroke and you have a hole. The topology of the cortex itself is fixed. Okay, so there are two different things. So the topology of the sheet in 3D is fixed, but the topology of these red-green patterns is variable. And so these vary highly across subjects. And so one of the things that by having a topology preservation term is we force these things not to fold in order to generate alignment. Okay? Yeah.
So the postnatal changes that you just described, mm-hmm. where you said you thought it got simpler, mm-hmm. I guess, how do you relate that to the comments that the data that Guido showed that the contrast in the first 6 months to a year mm-hmm. becomes severely eroded? And so.
Well, so there's. Okay, so I didn't see Guido's talk. So I can't comment on that. There's a lot of stuff that's going on in the first year. So there are T2 changes, there are T1 changes, there are proton density changes, and they relate to different processes. So I don't know why I'm explaining this to you. You know this better than I do. The myelin is winding tighter, it becomes more hydrophobic, the water is expelled from the tissue, and so you get these changes in the T1, the T2, and the proton density. In the typical imaging, there's a crossover point where on a T1-weighted scan, you will see no contrast. But the underlying T1s, T2s, and PDs still have some contrast between them. And where you get that crossover point depends on how PD weighted and how T1 weighted your scans are, or T2 star weighted. So I don't know if that. What we see is actually a geometry change.
You're confident that it's not an erosion in segmentation quality as opposed to a.
So confident would probably be too strong. We've seen it frequently. I would be surprised but not astonished if it was not true. Okay? Okay, so on to. Yeah.
So in your alignment in your registration of the spherical maps or smooth mm-hmm. surface maps, mm-hmm. you use the variance as a way to weight some landmark mm-hmm. or soci more than others. But some of the more variable soci become less variable as you align the less variable soci. So mm-hmm. have you thought of an iterative process where you recalibrate this estimate of
So this is a great question, and I'm going to talk about it in more detail later. The answer is the way we do it is kind of dopey. We start with an individual, we align to that with kind of a somewhat more rigid morph, and then we redo things, re-estimating the variance. Let me actually, so I'm going to talk about it in this part quite a bit, so I'll defer it to that, but it's I think it's a really interesting question, how you compute the variance, and what's really variance, and what's just your registration algorithm failing. Okay.
Hey Bruce, what did you actually expand in your labeling expansion on the actual triangular mesh? What do you expand, you know, for the graphs that you're showing, what do you actually expand, what's the signal that you're expanding?
That's a good question. So we don't have a good answer to that. What we're doing now is the coordinate functions. And the coordinate functions are not, you know, they're not invariant to anything. So we typically do some type of registration to obtain a coordinate system across subjects and then expand the coordinate functions. We've looked at doing, I mean, I think the right way to do it would be to use one of the fundamental forms and expand those, but we have not sorted that out yet. Actually, my graduate student is working on it, graduated, so it's not even like we're working on sorting it out. Okay, so on to the rest of the brain. So what time should I shoot for ending, Paul? So we started a little late. So just go until I faint? Okay. Okay, so I'm going to talk about kind of the rest of the brain, right? So I talked about cortex. Now, how do we segment volumetric data into semantically meaningful tissue classes? So here, actually, our goal really isn't to segment T1 weighted. It's to segment any MR into anatomically and semantically meaningful structures, so the ventricular system, the basal ganglia, the hippocampus, the amygdala, this kind of thing. We want this procedure to be insensitive to pathology because we want to study pathology with it. And we would like it to be insensitive to the details of the pulse sequence used to acquire the data because we don't care about the pulse sequence, right? We care about the brain. And I'm actually not going to talk about that too much either. So here, we actually want an anatomically, a three-dimensional coordinate system because we're studying three-dimensional objects as opposed to before. Okay, so this is my standard why segmentation is hard. I know we had a segmentation talk earlier today. So this is T1 weighted intensity on the horizontal axis. This is kind of probability of class membership vertically. So, and each of the different colors is a different structure. This is manually labeled data. So this is white matter, gray matter, the lateral ventricles, the thalamus, the caudate, the putamen, the pallidum, the hippocampus, and the amygdala. And so what you can take from this slide is that on a T1 weighted image, the ventricles are dark, they're pretty easy to segment, and the rest of the brain is a mess. And so even white matter here in green has lots of overlap with pallidum in blue. That's why we call it pallidum. It's pale, it has a lot of myelin in it. So on a T1 weighted MR, it looks a lot like the white matter. Okay, so that's one point. So this is a fundamentally ill-posed problem. If I give you a T1 weighted voxel intensity, you cannot with any confidence tell me just from the intensity what tissue class it's a member of. Okay? So that's point number one. Point number two is that there's a lot of structure in these distributions. Like the pallidum does not look like the hippocampus. They look different. They have different signal properties. And so taking all this stuff and making them all a single Gaussian makes life much harder than it has to be. And the truth is that the reason that it doesn't have to be hard is only if you have access to manually labeled data, which we do, which I'll show in a second. Okay, so one of the things that we're going to do is we're never going to average tissue intensities across different classes, and I'll get back to that in a second. Okay, so here we want to do volumetric intersubject registration. The goal is to align functionally homologous points across subjects, right? I want to take this point in my brain and, you know, align it with the same point in Mike's brain. The problem is that we have no idea what the functional homology is. This is kind of the fundamental goal of the human brain mapping, is trying to understand these functional homologies. Okay, so we don't know the functional homology. Instead, maybe we would like to align structures. We'd like to align hippocampus with hippocampus and amygdala with amygdala, etc. But we don't know the structural homologies either. This is kind of our goal. We've given you a novel image, and you have to segment it. You don't know what hippocampus is yet before you've established this coordinate system. So the alternative, the typical solution, is to align image intensities and hope that this alert results in both functional and structural alignment. Okay, so the standard way to do this, and there are many packages that will do this, including ours, is to find some function that minimizes the sum squared error between an individual and some target ALIS. Right, so I want to find some functional transformation. In this case, it's a 12-parameter affine transform that minimizes this functional. And then hope that that results in the alignment of functional and structural homology. In the establishment of functional and structural homology. So what does this mean probabilistically? If I look at this from a probabilistic standpoint, it means that I'm modeling the noise in the image as, T is the target image, I is the embedded image, R is the spatial coordinate. It means that this function F I'm looking for is the maximum likelihood solution, assuming the image noise can be modeled as a set of IID random variables, so independent and identically distributed across space, with the mean of the target intensity and unit variance. And this is the part that I really want to take issue with, this fact that the target intensity that the intensity of a single voxel is well modeled by a single number across subjects. Okay, so when we were first writing this segmentation stuff, I had no interest in writing a new registration procedure because there are many extremely clever registration algorithms out there and many that are publicly distributed that are easy to use. And what we found is that the easy to use ones that are publicly distributed fail on pathological data. So here is an Alzheimer's brain. Here's just the standard M&I atlas. And here's the result of the optimal affine transform. So I think you would agree this is not an excellent alignment. And so the problem here is actually quite easy if we look at what our underlying probabilistic model is. So here's an example of an Alzheimer's brain. It has huge ventricles, right? It's got atrophied gray matter, big ventricles, etc. And so if I take a point in the brain, let's say this point here, whoops, my wandering mouse, this is a point. Okay, so one thing you might think is, okay, well, I'm taking, you know, an 80-year-old with Alzheimer's, and I'm trying to align it with a bunch of 20-year-old brains. What if I just take a bunch of 80-year-olds, or some 80-year-olds and some 20-year-olds, and I build an atlas with all of them, and I'll align it to that? Does that solve the problem? And the answer is no, depending on how you do your modeling. And the reason is that if we take a place like this in the brain, it's a point that's ventricle in the elderly and in Alzheimer's and in various neurodegenerative diseases, so it has dark intensity on a T1-weighted image. It's a point that's, It's a point that's white matter in most 20-year-olds, so it's bright on a T1-weighted image. If I average those two intensities, I get something that looks like gray matter, which is a tissue class that never occurs at this location in the brain. So really the problem here is that the fundamental probabilistic atlas is not sophisticated enough to handle the fact that there are multiple tissue classes can occur at the same location. Okay, so one alternative is to integrate your segmentation and your registration. So we want to find some transformation that maximizes the probability that each point in the individual is drawn from one of a set of tissue classes in the template. Okay, so if I knew the segmentation in an individual, then doing the registration would be easy, right? So here, L is the segmentation, C is the segmentation, right, so, and I is an image. So if I knew the segmentation, then I could say, okay, well, I want to align hippocampus in this individual, and I know where it is because it's C, and I know where it is in the atlas, it's L, and I'll just find a transformation that causes them to overlap. But of course, I don't know the segmentation. This is exactly what we're trying to find. Okay, so how do we find the segmentation C if we want to use this type of formalism? Well, so a brain has about 2 million voxels in it. An affine transform has 12 degrees of freedom. This problem is ridiculously overdetermined. I have way more information than I need in order to find just an affine transform. And so the game that we play is that in our atlas, we actually have exactly information we need in order to find locations in the brain that are stable across subjects. Right? We have manually labeled data. We can say this point is always ventricle. So in our atlas, we can search for points, say a few thousand of them, where the segmentation problem is trivial, where only one tissue class ever occurs. And those few thousand points are actually enough to compute an affine transform across subjects. So skip that one. And because we have access to manually labeled Alzheimer's data, for example, we built models of the changes induced by the pathology into our atlas registration procedure. And so the procedure itself is invariant to the pathology, kind of by construction. Okay? I mean, this stuff is kind of simple. This is low-dimensional transforms. But it works exceedingly well in the face of pathology.
By the way, that was a really clever idea when I understood you.
Oh. Thank you.
I put that in a clever column.
Okay.
Good one.
So here's access to the manually labeled data. This is really what allows us to do a lot of the modeling that we're doing. Because we have the Center for Morphometric Analysis at MGH, these are, and I'm sorry if I insult anyone in the audience, you know, these are 22-year-olds who want to go to med school, they want to go to grad school, and they've indentured themselves for some period of time to sit in darkened rooms and manually label brains. And it's incredibly valuable for us because now we have access to this type of manually labeled data that we can extract statistics from. So here's a coronal view, here's a sagittal view through the medial temporal lobe. So this is hippocampus, so the amygdala, pallidum, putamen, thalamus, ventricles. And another thing to take from this slide is that the manual labeling is not perfect. It's so hard to do this that it's easy to make this kind of mistake. So here's a couple of voxels that should be hippocampus, but actually they were labeled as cortex. Okay. So here we are. We know our atlas transformation. We still want to find the segmentation in the rest of the brain. How can we do this? So the typical game that we play is we use Bayes' rule, and we flip this around so that we have the likelihood of the image and priors on the space of allowable segmentations. So I'm not going to talk much about the image likelihoods. I think one of the interesting things that you can do with the image likelihoods is you can actually build models of the physics into the likelihoods. Because really, this is a model of image formation. It says, if I knew what the tissue class was, say hippocampus, what do I predict the intensity would look like? And that prediction can actually include models of the physics that allow you to say, well, I know what the pulse sequence that was used in order to image this brain, and I know what the underlying magnetic properties of the tissue are, but I'm not going to talk about that today. Instead, I'm going to talk about these priors on allowable segmentations. So if I don't have any spatial priors, if I just, at each point in the brain, say, what's the probability that this class came from this point, and what's the probability that the image was produced from that class, I get a segmentation that looks like this. So this is a sagittal view through the medial temporal lobe again. And, you know, it's not wrong, but it's not right either. So here's hippocampus, and most of hippocampus is right, and here's the amygdala, and most of it's right. But you can see that here's a couple of voxels labeled hippocampus that are in a sea of cortex. And we know anatomically this never happens. But of course, the model that I've shown you so far has no spatial constraints. And what's happened is that this voxel, while spatially it's in the right place to be cortex, its voxel intensity is right at the hippocampus class mean. And so the algorithm, you know, happily calls it hippocampus and goes on. Okay, so we need to encode some spatial constraints into our modeling. And what we're going to use is what are called Gibbs priors. And we're going to model the segmentation as a Markov random field. And what a Markov random field means is that the probability of a given label at a given location, given the rest of the labels in the brain, we're going to assume is equal to the probability of that label given only a small neighborhood around the label. Right? So this makes it computational tractable. This problem is not tractable. You know, I can't, for every voxel, say, let me look at the other 2 million voxels in the brain and see how that affects the probability of this voxel. But here, I can say, given this voxel, let me look at the 9 voxels around it or the 27 voxels around it and see if that makes sense to me. Okay, I think I'll skip this one. And so here's what it looks like graphically. So this has been used in image processing a lot, these MRFs. In the brain, what we're going to do that's a little bit different is we're going to let the MRF be anisotropic and non-stationary. And what that means is that the probabilities in the different directions, we'll allow them to be different. And so the probability that this voxel is hippocampus, given that that class is amygdala, is very different than the probability that this is hippocampus if that's amygdala. So there's this stereotypical spatial relationship between brain structures that really never changes. So amygdala is always above and in front of hippocampus. It's never below it. It's never behind it. Right? And so what this amounts to is a huge number of constraints on the space of allowable segmentations that allows us to take this type of noisy segmentation and iteratively recompute voxel label probabilities to generate these more coherent, more accurate segmentations. Okay, is that clear? Okay, so this is a gratuitous fly-through, just to show that we're labeling every voxel in the brain, so something like 2 million voxels. Okay. I think I'll skip that. So where's Paul? You really want me to just keep wandering on endlessly? Okay, so I'll do one more thing now. Okay.
It's still data.
It's still data. Okay. Sure, I can do like 30 slides.
I feel bad interrupting this a little bit.
No, that's okay. I'll do this last little bit. I have about 6 slides and then I'll be done. Okay, so I want to talk about linking microstructure and macrostructure. So there are many microstructural properties of the brain that have been used to parcelate the brain into different structural regions. This is the most famous of them. This is Corbinian-Brodmann in 1909, where he looks at the tissue under a microscope. And what you find is that the laminar properties of the cortex are relatively uniform within an area, and then there's a somewhat abrupt transition, although how abrupt it is open to debate, to a different set of laminar properties. And again, if it was only these structural facts that, if this was only true structurally, then this probably wouldn't be that interesting. But the structural properties correspond extremely well to the functional properties. So in some ways, these are thought to be the functional modules of the brain. Okay? So this is by far the most famous cortical parcellation ever done in the history of humanity. But it was 100 years ago. So can we do any better than this now? Okay, so here we're massively indebted to a set of work by Carl Zillis, Katrina Munz, these labs in Jülich and Düsseldorf. And what they do is they do whole brain histology. So they have a whole brain microtome, and they physically slice the tissue. And then they look at the tissue under a microscope, and they generate these line profiles. So this is the gray-white border, this is the peel surface. And they look at the intensity, essentially, of the microscopic image as you go from gray-white border out to peel surface. And that intensity reflects the laminar properties of the tissue. So the distribution of cell types, the amount of myelin, all this stuff is reflected in that line profile. And where the line profiles change abruptly is where they mark the borders between different structural areas. Okay, is that clear? So so this is the area 18 and 19 border. And you can see it's incredibly hard to see, right? Is there really a difference between here and there? So an anatomist would say yes. It's, David probably can see it. I can't see it. Okay, so they published a series of papers that really, to me, drive a stake through the heart of the telerect coordinate system as something useful for cortex. So here are four separate images. These are two papers published by Katrina Muntz. So what they do is they take 10 neurologically healthy subjects, they do the whole brain histology, they label a bunch of cortical areas, so these are labels generated under the microscope, and then they do telerect alignment on them, so 12-parameter affine alignment across subjects, and they just say how well does each cortical area align in this coordinate system. They just count, right? So for each point in the brain, they say, well, five subjects, this was area V1, or four subjects, or three subjects, and here's the color bar here. So this is one subject, this is all 10 subjects aligning. This is Brodmann area 17, it's primary visual cortex. It is by far the most stable architectonic feature of the brain. And in the telerect coordinate system, you know, there are a couple of voxels here at the center of V1 that line up, but the rest of them don't. And this just gets worse. So here's V2, the second visual area. There are almost no voxels where all subjects agreed. And then as I get to higher areas, this is Broca's area 44 and 45, the mean of the distribution is around three or four subjects. Right? So as a coordinate system for aligning cortical areas, it completely fails. Okay? So there are two possibilities here. One is that, you know, by some unfortunate quirk, the microstructural properties are not predicted by macroscopically observable stuff. Right? We just can't tell. It just moves around all over the place. The other, which, you know, as you can guess, I will argue for, is that this is just a poor way to do it. That really it's the folding patterns that are better predictors of the microstructural properties, not the image intensities. Anyway, so Carl and Katrin were kind enough to give me their data. We reconstructed surfaces. We did our standard spherical averaging on the surface space, and we generated the equivalent maps, except using spherical averaging. And what you find is that the alignment is excellent. And so here's Brodmann area 17, V1. So it goes from full yellow, which is all the subjects agreeing, to full black, none of the subjects agreeing, in about 2.5 millimeters, so smaller than the size of an fMRI voxel. So this functionally defined, well, this structurally defined area, which also has a functional correlate, is perfectly predicted by the folding patterns. And in fact, as you go kind of up the cortical hierarchy, you find that they're less and less predicted. And as we get to Broca's area, it's not perfectly predicted, but it's not so poorly predicted. There's still this kind of core region where we're 100% certain we're in Broca's area. Okay, so that's right hemisphere, this is the left. And then, okay, I'll skip. No, we'll skip.
How much is feedback that's
this one, that one? This one?
Yeah.
Yeah, this is.
So just give me a sense of distance there. I ought to be able to figure it out.
I'll do this one. Okay, so this is the mean Hausdorff distance. It's not really a Hausdorff distance, but it's the mean distance between the boundaries of the adjacent areas. So if I take all the subjects and I map them into a single subject, then I can measure the distance between the boundary in that subject's Brodmann area and the projected Brodmann area. And so this is the left hemisphere, right hemisphere, V1. This is motor cortex, then some of the somatosensory cortex, V2. So this is about, for V1, it's about 2.5 millimeters or so. Okay, and you know, you kind of see this gradual increase as you get into higher cortical areas. Okay, so this was a very long answer to your question about variances, but I want to get back to it because I think this is a very interesting question. So the variances, as I said before, amount to this natural weighting in the coordinate system. And when we did this, when we did this study, we'd actually optimized on a separate data set that I'll talk about in 1 second, where we said, can we optimize the overlap? And what we found is that the optimal overlap actually came in a fairly well-constrained morph. These kind of wildly under-regularized warps aligned the brains, but they didn't align the underlying Brodmann areas. It was a pretty well-regularized warp that did. And so one other question that we've been asking is what space should we be computing these variances? Right, so I can do what I described before. I can take one brain and align everyone to it and then recompute the variances and keep going. But an alternative, when we have these labels, and this is work that, that Thomas is doing, and Mert, I should point out. Okay, now I really have to be done. An alternative is to actually align the labels. Right? We know the labels are the proper homology across subjects, so we can do label matching and then align and then compute the variances in this label match space. And so the label matching doesn't use any of the geometry to do the alignment. All it does is says I want to align the labels. And where the geometry aligns, then this means that the geometry is probably too strong, may be predictive of the underlying labels. Right? So we can do label matching and then compute the variance, where's the variance, down here in this label match space. And what you find, if you do that, so this is the original one I showed you, if we build an atlas from this label match space and look at the variances there and do alignment into that atlas, that it actually reduces the error. Right? So here we're doing geometric alignment, but the space we do the calculation of the variances in is in a label match space where we've aligned the underlying labels, not the geometry. Okay. So maybe I'll just end with that and not show you any of the ex vivo data, as beautiful as it is. Okay, and so I tried to point people out as I gave the talk. Thank you very much.